The Catra Podcast Conversations for the Curious, Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Catra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're diving into, well, it's perhaps one of the single most overwhelming topics in global history, the British Empire.
It really is, and it's a subject just loaded with political argument, emotional weight. Often when people talk about it, they kind of default to these huge sweeping narratives, either, you know, total celebration or complete condemnation. Mm-hmm. It's often hard to find that middle ground.
Exactly. And that's really why we're here today. Our mission is to try to move past those binaries and use the essential analysis of historian Ashley Jackson to understand how this colossal global network actually worked, you know, on the ground.
Yeah, looking for the nuance, the complexity.
And most importantly, some practical understanding.
And that understanding, it's pretty much non-negotiable if you want to grasp the 21st century. Mm-hmm. The empire isn't just like history sitting on a dusty shelf somewhere.
Right.
It's legacies. I mean, the financial systems they set up, the often arbitrary borders drawn across whole continents, the deep-seated patterns of global inequality, they profoundly shape contemporary life, politics, culture. Today. Right now.
Okay, so let's meet our guide for this pretty complex journey. Who is Ashley Jackson, and why should we trust him to synthesize something this huge?
Well, Ashley Jackson is a professor of imperial and military history at King's College London. He's really one of the leading authorities in this field. And what makes his work so essential, I think, is his methodology.
How so? I mean, lots of historians write about the empire.
True, but Jackson is a master synthesizer. He's done just vast research in archives across multiple continents. That gives him this ability to integrate both the sort of metropolitan British perspective, what London intended, with the actual lived experiences of people in the colonies.
Okay. So not just top down.
Exactly. He dissects the imperial system as a historical structure, focusing on how power was really wielded, but without becoming, you know, an apologist on one side or a fierce critic on the other. He really aims for clarity.
And that clarity is so vital here, because if there's one essential takeaway from his analysis, it's that famous map, you know, the one painted solid red covering a quarter of the globe. It's totally deceptive.
It really is the ultimate visual lie, isn't it?
Yeah.
Jackson's central premise is that the British Empire was fundamentally not a single monolithic, centrally controlled entity.
Right.
It was diverse, improvisational, often contradictory. A global network, what he brilliantly calls a patchwork empire.
A patchwork that implies like different fabrics, different stitching, maybe varying quality, sounds much less impressive, maybe less coordinated than a single perfectly tailored suit.
Precisely. And that leads to the really astonishing core question he tackles. How did a relatively small island nation manage to control nearly a quarter of the world's population?
Yeah, how did they do that?
And the answer, he argues, lies in that highly varied, adaptable, almost improvised nature of their control. It wasn't one single system. It was many systems kind of running side by side.
Okay, let's dive into that patchwork idea then, the different types of rule, because the diversity is, well, it's staggering when you look at it. Governing India, for instance, seems like a whole different ballgame compared to governing Canada.
Oh, absolutely. Worlds apart. So at one end of the spectrum, you have the dominions. Think Canada, Australia, New Zealand.
Right, the settler colonies.
Exactly. Predominantly settled by European migrants, and they were pretty quickly given vast self-governing powers. For the British, this was, you know, colonization as nation building, but primarily for white settlers.
Okay. Then you jump across the globe to the Indian Empire, the famous jewel in the crown.
And this was the absolute bedrock. Mm. Economically, militarily, administratively, it underpinned the whole system. Yeah. It was unique in its sheer scale and complexity, ruled partly by the very rigid Indian civil service, that bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. But also through these really careful alliances with hundreds of local princely states, they kept a degree of semi-autonomy, but under British oversight. So a massive bureaucracy layered on top of older ways of ruling.
Fascinating. And then contrasted against that, you had smaller but maybe strategically crucial places.
Yes, the Crown colonies. Places like Hong Kong, Singapore, these were ruled much more directly from London via an appointed governor. They existed mostly as trade hubs or strategic choke points on global routes.
Got it. So dominions, India, crown colonies. What's the last major piece of the patchwork?
That would be the protectorates, especially across large parts of Africa. This often involved the cheapest, most, let's say, pragmatic form of control. indirect rule.
How did that work?
Britain would sign treaties with local rulers, promising protection, often, frankly, protection from other European powers, scrambling for territory in exchange for control over their foreign policy, and crucially, access to essential economic resources.
So less direct administration, more managing through existing local power structures.
Exactly. This diversity really shows the British were less concerned with, say, ideological consistency, and much more focused on what worked locally to ensure economic benefit and strategic advantage. It was highly flexible imperialism, very pragmatic.
But okay, flexibility aside, how did this handful of British administrators and soldiers actually maintain that kind of sprawling control over hundreds of millions of people? This is where Jackson's analysis of the mechanisms of power, the dual pillars, becomes really central, right?
That's the absolute core insight, the mechanics of it all. Imperial power, he argues, was this ongoing strategic balancing act, and it rested on two pillars, both equally essential, coercion and collaboration.
Coercion seems the most obvious one, the iron fist.
Yes, absolutely. The foundation was always military superiority, the global reach of the Royal Navy, the technological edge of the British Army. But, and this is key, Jackson emphasizes, the British Army itself was actually tiny compared to the task.
Really? How did they project power then?
Its power came from the constant threat of force and the proven willingness to brutally suppress any large-scale rebellion when it occurred. And crucially, that force wasn't just British soldiers. It was massively augmented by locally recruited soldiers.
Well, like the Indian Army.
The Indian Army is the prime example, hugely powerful. So local troops were essential to the coercion pillar itself.
Okay, so the force projection was real, but using only British soldiers day to day across the entire empire, that would have been prohibitively expensive, logistically just impossible.
Completely unsustainable. And that's exactly where the second pillar, collaboration, the velvet glove, if you like, had to come in.
Right. Force secures the territory initially, maybe, but collaboration actually runs the system day to day.
Precisely. The empire absolutely required local consent, or perhaps more accurately, compliance, from existing elites. The British actively co-opted local princes, chiefs, merchants, low-level administrators.
Why would local elites agree to that?
Well, these local figures often retain their status, their wealth, their local power, or sometimes gain new economic opportunities by aligning their interests with the imperial power structure. It was a pragmatic choice for many.
So if you picture, say, a tax collector or a minor judge in an African protectorate or an Indian province, chances are they weren't British.
Very likely they were a local person, a collaborator, in Jackson's framework, essentially running the machinery of empire on Britain's behalf.
Wow.
This indirect rule was, you know, a masterful system in terms of efficiency, though obviously deeply morally complex. The vast majority of people enforcing laws, collecting taxes, administering territory, they weren't British. They were locals who had decided for various reasons that working within the imperial system was their best option. Profit, status, security, maybe a mix.
Jackson makes it clear then that without this active role of local collaborators, the patchwork empire just couldn't have functioned. It would have unraveled.
Instantly, he argues. Their agency was fundamental to holding it all together.
Okay, that structural analysis, coercion, and collaboration gives such a clear picture of how they held on to power. If we step back a bit now, what are the most critical, the most enduring impacts of this patchwork system that Jackson wants us to understand?
Right, the long-term consequences. Well, first is undoubtedly economic transformation and global integration. The empire didn't just, you know, grab resources. It fundamentally reshaped the entire world economy.
How so?
It essentially created the first truly global economic system, with London finance right at the center. It shifted from older mercantilist ideas to a system of so-called free trade in the 19th century.
But free trade with a catch?
A big catch. It was a system designed and weighted heavily in Britain's favor. The colonies typically became specialized suppliers of cheap raw materials, think cotton from India, tea from Ceylon, rubber from Malaya.
And at the same time, they became captive markets for expensive British manufactured goods.
Exactly. That model created these profound patterns of economic dependency, locking colonies into specific roles.
And those patterns of dependency link to another key theme, don't they?
Absolutely. Theme two is cultural exchange and transformation. Now, the British definitely pushed their civilizing mission, spreading the English language, their legal systems, education, religion.
A standard narrative.
Right. But Jackson really stresses this was never just a one-way street. British culture itself was fundamentally changed by the empire. Think about food, words entering the English language, art, fashion.
Curry becoming a national dish, for example.
Perfect example. And just as importantly, colonized peoples weren't passive recipients. They actively adapted, reshaped, and repurposed British institutions, language, and ideas. Often, ironically, to fuel their own anti-colonial resistance movement and forge their own unique hybrid modern cultures.
So, a much more dynamic interaction than usually portrayed. And the final key theme.
That has to be the enduring and contested legacy. The empire's rapid, often completely arbitrary border drawing, especially during the late 19th century scramble for Africa, and perhaps most devastatingly, the partition of India and Pakistan, sowed the seeds for deep, persistent regional conflicts that are still playing out today. But it also established global institutions like the Commonwealth and cemented English as the global lingua franca. The memory, the meaning, the legacy of the empire, it's not settled history. It's fiercely debated global politics right now.
It really is. And that makes Jackson's way of summarizing things so powerful. His statements really cut through the noise.
They do. They highlight these complex interactions very effectively.
I was struck by the succinctness. He argues, and I'm paraphrasing slightly here, the British Empire was less a centrally run, monolithic entity and more a varied patchwork of territories. Just that one sentence forces you to ditch the simple narrative straight away.
It does. And then concerning how it was actually run, this idea is critical. Imperial power rested on a dual foundation, the ever-present threat of overwhelming force and the essential collaboration of local peoples. It makes you confront the active role in the moral dimensions involved in just maintaining the system day to day.
Yeah, the agency on both sides. And my favorite, I think, summarizes the sheer historical scale of it. The empire's greatest legacy may be its role in creating the first truly global system of economic, political, and cultural relationships. For better or worse, it wired the world together in a way nothing had before.
Absolutely. And understanding those core structural forces, the patchwork, the coercion collaboration dynamic, that's the key to seeing the real life applications today. Jackson's historical lens is incredibly practical, actually.
Okay, Ed, give us a couple of clear examples. How does this historical analysis help us understand current events?
Well, take understanding global conflict. If you look closely at many conflicts today in parts of the Middle East, South Asia, Africa, they're often rooted directly in those arbitrary lines drawn on maps by colonial powers.
Lines that ignored existing ethnic, religious, or tribal boundaries.
Completely ignored them in many cases. The way colonial administration worked, and then often the very careless way decolonization happened, fundamentally set the stage for current crises. You really can't understand potential solutions without grasping that original historical interference.
That makes sense. And what about the economic side?
Look at debates around economic inequality globally. Understanding that colonial economies were often deliberately structured to create dependency-forcing specialization in just one or two raw materials, preventing local industrialization, helps explain why many formerly colonized nations still struggle.
Struggle to diversify their economies, break free from cycles of debt.
Exactly. The structure of that initial unequal relationship is still in many ways kind of baked into global trade systems and financial relationships today.
So beyond specific conflicts or economic issues, what's the broader takeaway for how we think?
I think ultimately, Jackson's method gives us a toolkit for critical thinking. By forcing us to see that power operates through this complex mix of visible force, yes, but also hidden local collaboration and consent, we get much better at questioning contemporary political rhetoric.
How so?
We learn to look beneath the surface to analyze current power structures, whether political or corporate. It teaches us to look for the patchwork nature of control, the deals being made, the local buy-in, even in modern global operations. It encourages skepticism towards simple narratives of power.
That really is the phenomenal aha moment for me in this analysis, realizing just how much the empire's success and its eventual decline too hinged on the day-to-day choices and actions of local populations.
Yeah.
Their collaboration, yes, but also their resistance when it emerged. It was never just a top-down force imposed from London without any local interaction.
I completely agree. That realization, that emphasis on local agency within the imperial structure is maybe the most valuable lesson. The importance of nuance, of looking at the evidence, of understanding that history is made by many actors.
Right.
And the legacy of the British Empire isn't some settled historical account you read about in a book. It's a living reality. It's shaping global wealth distribution, political alliances, cultural identities, right now as we speak.
And you see that so clearly in those ongoing, often heated global debates, don't you? Discussions about apologies for slavery, arguments about reparations, the controversies over returning cultural artifacts held in Western museums like the Elgin Marbles.
Exactly. All that shows that the history of the empire isn't past. It's fundamentally shaping our present and our future. And Jackson's work provides that essential, nuanced historical framework we need to engage with those unavoidable debates intelligently and constructively.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akacha Foundation.